So now it is my pleasure to welcome you to the session for young adults, Life Beyond High School. This afternoon's session is presented by Dr. Lisa Kabrinsky. Dr. Kabrinsky is an associate professor in allergy division in the Department of Pediatrics at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. She is also an attending physician at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. Please help me in welcoming Dr. Kabrinsky.
All right, so you have to let me know if you have any difficulty hearing me because sometimes I'm very soft-spoken. So I'm really happy to give this talk. I think this is a really great topic, and it is something that comes up very frequently in my office. And, you know, I kind of hope to see a little more young people, but I'm not surprised that we don't have that many in here because this is a tough topic to deal with. And I think that this is not unique to PIDD. We see this with everybody. I mean, I can tell you my own daughter, I said to her, "So, what do you want to do after high school?" And she said, "I don't know." That's the response I get most of the time. So, what do you do after high school? Well, you have lots and lots of choices. You know, I don't tell people that there's a right thing or a wrong thing here, but some decision has to be made. So, you can go to a four-year school. One of the benefits of that is you can stay on your parents' health insurance, which is not a small deal. So, that's nice. Depending on what you want to do, likely gives you better opportunities for employment. And good employment usually means good health insurance. But that's not the only thing that you can do. You can go to a two-year school or go to a vocational program. Again, the whole idea here is to build a repertoire of skills that then translate into full-time employment later on. Doesn't matter what you do. Now, there are different laws in different states, but most states have rules that say that if you have a child who has disabilities, they can continue to do special education, sometimes even in the like the high school type setting, up until age 21. So that's nice. It gives you a lot of extra time to figure out what you're going to do. You need to take advantage of that. Now, I don't know in your local community what the rules are. So you either contact your local public health or public school system, you can contact the insurance commissioner in your state and find out what the rules are for children and extending their insurance on the parents' plans. Or you can enroll in a job training program. There are lots and lots of jobs out there that will pay for you to go to school, to get trained, to be an electrician, to be a computer repair person. And those are very good paying, skilled jobs. Again, the theme here is do something where you can get good health insurance. That's really the name of the game when you have any chronic disease. So, you know, we said life after high school, okay? We said young adults. Well, when do you become an adult? You know, people think, okay, 18, I'm an adult. And, you know, my daughter said to me, "Yay, I can't wait to be 18. I'm going to be an adult. It's going to be so exciting. Yay." And then 2 weeks after her 18th birthday, she said, "You know, I'm not sure I really want to be an adult anymore." I said, "Okay, well, that's normal." You know, I mean, people get very frustrated because they're like, "Well, when are they going to grow up and become an adult?" Well, it's hard to be an adult, you know? I mean, kids start when they're two. They go through a phase of they want to be independent, but at the same time, they want structure. And I think that that's natural. So becoming an adult means negotiating this whole independence-dependence thing. You know, when are you ready to be independent? How much do you need to depend on your parents, on other caregivers? You know, if you're going to go to become an adult, you have to start preparing for this. It doesn't happen magically on their 18th birthday. And I think that a lot of people tend to wait until they are 17 and a half before they start talking about this transition. Really, that discussion should have started happening when they were 14, because it takes a long time to kind of build this. And one of those things is not only this idea of, okay, what are you going to do with your life, but you know, what's going to happen to your health care? And So most immunologists, and I don't know what the experience of most people, but most of us are based in pediatrics. In Europe, it's not necessarily like that, but that's just been the way it's been in this country, that most of the immunologists are based in children's hospitals. And in my own experience, up until recently, that wasn't a problem. I took care of 60-year-olds and 70-year-olds in my pediatric clinic. So, you know, they have to put up with the weird waiting rooms and the small tables, but otherwise they didn't really care. But then the children's hospital started saying, oh, no, you can't see them here after they're 21. And I think that more and more that is going to be the state of affairs for patients. So then what do you do? Because a lot of people who trained in an internal medicine program, they don't know very much about primary immunodeficiencies. That wasn't one of the things that they saw a lot of. So what do you do at that point? So that means homework, and that takes time. So finding a way to transition the care to another provider is a big deal. And the more complicated the condition is, the more issues there are, the less autonomy the child is going to have, and the more they're going to continue that feeling of dependence on their parents. So those are not easy questions to resolve, but keeping in mind all of the different pieces of it is very helpful, and then starting the transition early and not waiting until they're 17 and a half is really key. So again, becoming an adult, how do you get that independence? Well, to be very blunt, you have to have some money. I mean, there's no two ways about it. You can be ready to go out there and take on the world and do everything, but, you know, as the old adage says, money doesn't grow on trees, right? So it's the sort of hard, cold light of day to realize that I really do have to stick to a budget. I really do have to live within my means. And you need some skills. So how many people have taught to their children about how to open a bank account? Okay, so a few people. How many people have actually had their teenagers open their own bank account? Good. How many people think that their kids know how to balance a checkbook? Okay, a few people. So, I mean, these are real life skills. And we don't do a good job teaching any of our kids about them. And just because you have a chronic disease, it doesn't exempt you from knowing how to do this stuff. So, again, earlier is better. You know, a lot of high schools have made lip service this idea that, well, we really should include, you know, something in our classes about how you balance your checkbook and, you know, how do you open a bank account. But, you know, I wouldn't really count on that. I mean, that's kind of got to be in your checklist of things to do. Okay, it's their 15th birthday. Let's go, you know, see how they do opening a bank account, or, you know, let's show them how to balance a checkbook. You know, I think there's sort of a developmental hierarchy of skills that they have to learn how to do. Now, how do they learn how to pay bills? How do they learn how to get a telephone hookup? How do they learn how to get the power turned on? I mean, these are all skills that we all learned at some point in life, but they're going to have to learn this too. And we're superimposing on top of that the skills they need to know how to negotiate the medical system. So never forget that both of those skills are really important. And you can't have independence without that. So, with regard to their responsibilities for their disease, they need to know what their disease is. I mean, every time when I have teens come into my clinic, I don't let the parents talk. If I can help it, I make the kids talk. Because I want to know that they know what their disease is. What is it called? What's the problem? What are the medicines that you take? Not just that thing in the bottle and the pills that look like this. No. What's the name of the pill? How often do you take it? What's the dose of your pill? If they don't know it, then I tell them, okay, here's a piece of paper. I'm going to tell you, write it down, and I want you to keep that piece of paper. And that's your homework. You have to go home and study it. That's really important. I mean, there are lots of adults that don't do this properly. But if you have a chronic disease, you have to do this. It's really important. It's also really a good idea to know why you take that medicine. Why do you need to be on this antibiotic or this antifungal or gamma globulin? What does it do for you? You need to understand that. The other thing that's really key is, who's your doctor? Do you know their name? Do you know where you see them? Do you know what their specialty is? I mean, it's very, very, very important for them to know who their doctors are. Because otherwise, they're not going to be able to communicate with their doctors later on. So that's just the background, just the knowledge. But then there's the practical stuff. So if I get gamma globulin infusions, how do I know when it's time for my next infusion? Who's the home care company? Who's the nurse who's going to call me up and set it up? If I run out of my antibiotic, how do I get a refill? How many refills do I have left? How do I get that in the pharmacy? I mean, you know, most pharmacies now will at least have automated reminders or things like that that help, but hey, you have to teach them how to do it. And the, oh, I don't like doing that, is not a reason not to do it. Okay, so somebody asked me the other day, well, how do you get your child to do that? I said, it's called tough love. You know, it's called, you put your foot down and say, no, I'm not going to do this for you anymore. I'm not going to enable you to be dependent on me. You have to do it. Now, sometimes the first few times you stand there while they're on the phone. Here's the phone number. Here's the prescription. Okay, go ahead, do it. Till they get used to doing it. But these are things that, you know, you're struggling with all these other things every single day. Oh, you know, trying to make sure that they're passing their math class or whatever. But this is just as important because this is what they need to be able to do to go on. Making their own doctor's appointments. You know, that's a tough one because they don't want to call the doctor's office. So what's the worst thing they're going to say to you? No, you can't come at that time? You know, it's not that difficult, but I think it's a very intimidating idea for them to get on the phone and call the doctor's office and try to do this. But it's a really important skill because when they go out, if they're at college or they're out of the house, you can't do it for them. They have to do it. So the last part is what I said. I make them talk to me. I often have to tell the parents, no, be quiet. Don't say anything. Okay? Just let them talk. Because if I don't hear what's on their mind, I can't treat them. I can't tell them do X, Y, Z when they're thinking to themselves, I'm never going to do that. I don't like that. Forget it. It doesn't help me. So, you know, when I've done these sessions, like sort of for IDF, the teen sessions, I tell the kids, I said, listen, if you don't speak up and say, I don't like that medicine, it makes me throw up or whatever, then you have no right to complain if I prescribe it for you and you don't like it. If you didn't speak up, that's your problem, okay? You have to be your own advocate. And just like we talk at IDF about how we are patient advocates, we have to teach our children who are the patients to be their own advocates. And this is part of the tough love. We are teaching them how to be their own advocates because down the road, it is going to be super important for them. So the other thing that comes along with being 18 is, guess what? You now have legal responsibility. How about that? And that's kind of scary. So what does that mean? Well, if you are over 18, in theory, I can't speak to your parents. I can't give them information about your medical condition anymore. I have to talk to you. Now, seriously? You know, that probably isn't really the way it happens because if they're a senior in high school and they're 18, you know that in my mind, they're still a minor and they're still at home and their parents are still bearing the responsibility. But the law says that if you're 18 and you get admitted to a hospital, in theory, you have to sign all of your own consents. So I don't know how many of you have ever read the full consent for any procedure. Have you ever read all, like, 4 or 5 pages? It's long, and it's full of lots of stuff that I don't even understand. And some of the stuff is really downright scary because everything carries a risk of death. and the risk of terrible things. And you're 18. Really? You're going to read that and you're going to go, well, I don't want to sign that. That sounds terrible. Well, okay. So a little bit of education there is important too. And we talk a lot about that when we talk about procedures and things like that, what the real risks are. And I always tell, you know, when we go through things and I say, oh, do you have any questions? That's the answer I get. And there's a little shake of the head. It's not even verbal. It's a little shake of the head. I said, no. Ask me one question. Think of a question. I don't care. You can ask me what my favorite color is. I don't really care, but think of a question. Okay? Because I want them, A, I want to know they heard what I said, and B, you have to get in the habit of asking questions. It's important to ask questions. And there are no dumb questions. I am never going to laugh in somebody's face and say, oh, that was a stupid question. But it's really important, because if you are not a partner in making the medical decisions, you are not going to get the care that you need. Okay? And I tell my patients this all the time. I am willing to work with you. We make all sorts of compromises about treatments and how to make things work, but I can only do that if I get feedback from my patients. I cannot do that unilaterally. So that's part of your responsibility as an adult, is to be a partner in this whole process. And I think a lot of kids as they grow up are used to being, well, people still view me, I'm just a kid and nobody's going to listen to what I have to say. But that's not true in this arena. And if your doctor is not going to listen to what you have to say, well, that's not a great relationship. That probably needs to be worked on. So I think that knowing that their voice is valid and that they can be listened to is important. And it's important to iterate that to them over and over and over again. That what you have to say counts, you are the patient, and you have to be involved in what's going on. You're not just there long for the ride. You are the patient. You have to take the medicine. You have to submit to the procedures. You have to be involved. Transitioning to all the adult specialists we talked about a little bit before, this is a big challenge. So even if you keep the same immunologist, you have to go see a gastroenterologist or a pulmonologist or dermatologist. And they, unlike immunologists, most of them are very clearly split. They are pediatric or they are adult. And some places are really fortunate to have a good network of adult specialists that they work with. So there are people that have some familiarity with primary immunodeficiencies. Most places do not. And so, again, this is where the idea of being informed about what your diagnosis is, what your treatments are, what your medicines are, why you take them, is really important. Because one of the things that happens very frequently in immunodeficiency clinic is that they come referred by their pediatrician. They're like, I don't really know why I'm here. Well, if you don't really know why you're here, then why did you make this appointment? I think that that's important. You go to see another doctor who doesn't know you, you better be able to tell them why you're there. And a corollary to that is the idea of the e-health record. So how many people here have signed up for the e-health record? Okay, pretty good number. So the e-health record is something that was started by the Primary Immunodeficiency Foundation. It is your electronic health record. I don't own it. IDF doesn't own it. But it has a web portal, which is advantageous because it means you can access it. It's not housed in a building locked away somewhere. And you can update it yourself. And what it allows you to do is to keep a record of your 15 sinus surgeries or your 3 admissions for pneumonia or your current IVIG therapy and what your last trough level was. It is an excellent way of keeping tabs of things and a lot easier than carrying around a notebook that's like yay thick, okay, which a lot of our patients do, and then they're flipping, trying to find out, well, where was that? Where was that scan or whatever? No, e-health record, I think, really is the way to go. And I encourage the teenagers to work with their parents to set it up. You know, they're pretty tech savvy, so this is not difficult for them to do, but they need a little help to get the background, to put the details in, to have it there. And going forward, updating it, okay? It is so much easier to go, oh, I'm going to the doctor, let me print out my list of my meds, so at least they have everything there when they walk into the doctor, especially with someone who's never seen them before. So this is, again, they don't mind about putting everything out there on Facebook. So there should be no reason why they mind about keeping tabs of this on a secure website, okay? But it's important. It takes time to do it. It really does. But it's well worth the time. So, you know, we talked a little bit about financial responsibility, you know, having a bank account, managing their budget, health insurance. You know, health insurance is an ever-changing landscape in this country. But it's very important for young adults to understand, how does this work? You know, how do you get health insurance? What's the difference between a POS and a PPO and an HMO and a healthcare spending account? Like, what's the difference? I mean, half the time, you know, you look at, you have Aetna, but say, which Aetna do you have? There's like 20 different plans you can have. I don't think that it's too early for a 10th or 11th grader for you to sit down and say, well, here's what our health insurance looks like. We have a $1,700 deductible every year. This is what that means. We have a copay each time we go to the doctor. This is what that means. This is, you know, if you go to the emergency room, this is what it ends up costing. Now, sometimes, you know, I understand there's a fear that, oh, this is going to make them incredibly anxious. Well, that's not the point. The point is to say, there are different ways that this can be done. This is the way that we have right now. But this is something to think about, because I have lots of young adults who come in the office. They're 21, they're getting ready to finish, and they're going to go and get a job. I mean, I had this just this week. And the mother comes with a sheet of paper and says, which one of these plans should I choose? I said, well, you need to call them up and you need to find out for your gamma globulin that you're going to get every month, how much you're going to have to pay out of pocket. It's not tough, but I can't always answer that question because I don't know what the plans cover. So teaching them ahead of time, these are the questions that they need to ask for. These are the people they need to talk to. These are the things they need to think about when they look at plans, is really doing them a service. Because this is not an easy thing to do. And it is very complicated sometimes. And I'm not saying that they're going to walk out tomorrow and they're going to be able to do all this on their own. But if you give them some of the tools to be able to ask the right questions, it is going to help immeasurably. So what about a child who is really not ready to be independent? You know, we have children who have special needs. We have children who have varying levels of ability. And, you know, quite honestly, there are children who are not going to be able to be independent from their parents. That's how it happens. Remember what I said, when you turn 18, it doesn't matter what your, you know, that's your chronological age. It doesn't matter what your developmental age is. You can be an 18-year-old that functions like an 8-year-old. You're all the same under the law. So what's your protection for that? You know, these are things that have to be decided on much earlier than 18. One of them is the power of attorney for medical decision-making or guardianship. So like I said, the day you turn 18, you no longer have really the right to sign consents for them. The kids are supposed to sign their own consents. So that has to get put in place, and it has to get put in place before their 18th birthday. In some situations, you would qualify for Social Security, for disability, for other benefits, which can either supplement insurance or to even take the place sometimes of health insurance. So those are things that I can't answer for you whether or not your particular child would qualify for it, but, you know, either the state offices of the Social Security, you know, Disability Bureau, or sometimes there are advocates within the healthcare system that can help tell you if you qualify. There are other, like I said, in many states, children with special needs can stay in school up until age 21. There are special programs also for what we call vocational rehabilitation, which is really just a job training program. So this is taking a child and having them do a program where they're actually working. They're going and having a job skill, learning how to do whatever, working in a grocery store, working in a warehouse, so that they do have a job skill, so that eventually maybe they will be able to be independent and earn their own living. So this is really, you know, when I say job training, it's kind of a mixture of school and on-the-job training. So they actually have a job, but it's considered kind of school. And while they're doing this, in many cases, this is a sort of first step to transitioning them to living semi-independently. Now, what that looks like depends on their abilities. Some of them may be able to function in a group home, but I will tell you that many group homes are not going to do their sub-Q gammaglobulin for them. They're not even going to have a nurse come to the house to the group home to do IV gammaglobulin. They don't do that usually. So these are considerations and things that have to be negotiated many times with that kind of a living situation. So, you know, really this is no different from any other chronic disease, whether you have diabetes, seizures. I mean, all these issues are going to be relevant for all of those. And another big one is, what do they do about their peers? I mean, do they have good friends? Have they told their good friends that they have an immune deficiency? What do their friends think about it? I mean, a lot of adolescents particularly do not want to be different. They do not want to be stigmatized. You know, and you know, we've been fighting this battle for a long time, but for us, immunodeficiency is not AIDS, right? I mean, this is a genetic immune deficiency. There are still people out there who don't understand the difference. And that's hard, because you don't want to start this very false idea of what you have. So a lot of our teens just don't say anything about it, because it's easier that way. So how does that impact their ability to have friendships? You know, that may be more difficult for them, because maybe they can't do everything that the kids go. They don't go to overnight summer camp because there are too many other issues. They are not taking that school trip to, you know, Nebraska because they can't be away from home for a week because they need to be able to do their therapy and their infusions. There are lots of things that may make them appear different from their peers, but different doesn't have to be abnormal. They just have certain constraints on the things they have to do. And I think that for the most part, I mean, most of our patients have a peer group that is very sympathetic to their needs, and they're not punishing of this. And particularly, I think, when they get a little bit older and they get into the college situation, at least among my patients, we have not had that experience of people giving them a hard time because they have an immune deficiency and they have to do an infusion once a month. And we're joking about, you know, what do they do? What do you do with them when they go to college and they need gammaglobulin? The answer is, you do what works. So we have some patients where they have a home care nurse that comes to the dorm once a month and do the infusion. And the mothers would tell me, oh, it's the greatest thing ever, because they know they have to clean up their room before the nurse comes, because otherwise she's going to kill them. And I'm like, great, fine, that works for you, okay? And then there are others who, they don't want to share this with anybody, so they go home once a month and do it. And the mom's like, oh, great, they come home and they do their laundry once a month. You know, it's what works for them. So sub-Q, at one session they asked, well, what about weekly sub-Q? Is that a reasonable option for college kids? Sure, it's a reasonable option as long as they have the time and a place to do it, which isn't always easy when you're in college. I mean, you've got a lot of stuff going on, and you may not remember to take a time out to do your sub-Q infusion once a week. So these are all very pragmatic conversations that you need to have. And again, if you don't tell me, oh, I'm never doing that in my dorm room, forget about it, I don't know. I mean, I ask the question now because I've learned over the years that you have to ask that question, but you have to be straight about it. I tell them, be straight, be upfront, at least tell me what you're going to do. That way we can work around it. We have lots of choices now. We have lots of ways we can give gammaglobulin. There is no excuse for us not being able to find a workable solution for this. Relationships are problematic also, you know, so they going to find that significant other person in their life. How much should they share about their disease? Well, hopefully they're going to share pretty much everything because they're going to need to at some point. And then finding a partner who's accepting of that and able to deal with it is not always easy. But, you know, we want them to have a relationship, maybe have a family, have kids. But it adds an additional layer of stress to the whole thing. Okay, so when you're talking about having a family and I have this chronic condition and I need really good health insurance and I'm going to have to do treatments every month, yeah, it's an extra layer of things to deal with. That being said, you know, I tell families early on when they get this diagnosis in the first place, listen, I'm seeing the children of some of my patients now. I mean, this is not, just because you have CGD or you have XLA, this does not mean that you're never going to find somebody and you're never going to grow up and you're never going to have kids. That's not the idea. The idea is that you have your family, you go on, you do what you're supposed to do. But it involves some tough conversations sometimes. And I think probably aside from the whole idea of financial responsibility, reproductive choices is probably the next most difficult thing to talk about. How is the disease inherited? You know, now, obviously for some things like CVID, IgA deficiency, we have no idea. But other things we know pretty well. So how old do they have to be before you start talking about this? 8? 18? I mean, there's no right or wrong answer. The answer is when they seem to be ready to do it, but certainly around this, for girls, certainly around the time that they hit puberty, there needs to be a little bit of a discussion about this, even boys too, especially if they have X-linked diseases. Now, what's the risk of passing it on? Depends on how it's inherited. Not always an easy concept to understand, but I will tell you any high schooler who's taking biology nowadays has actually talked about inheritance of X-linked and autosomal recessive diseases. And, you know, I know this because I looked at my own children's biology textbooks and figured, you know, that they had a pretty good explanation of it. So this should be a concept they should be able to understand, even if the parents can't remember how this works, okay? But what if we don't know what the gene is? Then what's the risk of passing it on to your children? We don't know. I mean, we don't think it's really higher than the general population, but the truth of the matter is we don't really know with all these diseases. So when can you test a sister? So say you have an X-linked disease in your family. So if you have an X-linked disease, the odds are very high that the mother did carry the abnormal X and passed it to the son. That means that 50% of the daughters will carry that abnormal X, and they can pass it along to a son. They're not sick with the disease. They don't have the disease, generally, but they can pass along. So how old do they need to be until you can test them to see if they're carriers? Well, I know a lot of parents who would say, oh, you know, test her now. But we are no longer actually allowed to do that by law. It goes back to this idea of consent. Because an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old can't really give informed consent about genetic testing. So we really have to wait till those girls are, depending on the state, 16 to 18, which by that point, they could already have had a baby, you know, that happens. So that's a difficult thing. So what do you do about that? So we still have the discussion with them. We have the discussion with the whole family when the kids are getting to the age of puberty to say, listen, we don't know whether or not you're a carrier, but there's a 50-50 chance that you are. And if you're a carrier, these are the odds. So, you know, some states are more lenient about that testing, but that's a tough conversation to have to tell them. And it's tough for young people to think about this, oh, well, that's not going to happen to me for, you know, 10 years. I don't need to think about it now. But the truth of the matter is, you always need to be aware of it and to think about it because you don't know. So we have this discussion. It's something that we do not infrequently. Sometimes there are other practices where they turf this to a genetic counselor, which is perfectly fine. But you know, it always needs to be raised. I mean, we do this very often, and I think if it's not being done, you either need to see a genetic counselor or at least ask your doctor about the reproductive risks, okay? So then when we have young adults who come and say, well, okay, you know, I'm ready, we want to start a family, and what are our options? Really don't want to have a kid with X-linked SCID. Just don't want to do that. Not going to do that. So what are your options? Well, you know, and this is not meant to have any sort of recommendation. This is just, these are options that people have. I mean, you can go ahead and have your child, and you take your chances, because if it's a boy, it's a 50-50 chance they'll have it. If it's a girl, 50-50 chance they'll carry it. Some people are okay with that. You can do in vitro fertilization. So you fertilize the egg with the sperm from the mom, biological mom and dad, and then after the spout 16 cells, they can check one of the cells and see if it has SCID or not. And if it doesn't have SCID, you can implant those. And then you're pretty much guaranteed that you're not going to have a child with SCID. You can use this, if depending on who the parent is. So if the mother's a carrier, you can use an egg donor. If the father has the disease, you can use a sperm donor. It's another option, do in vitro fertilization, or you can adopt. So, I mean, there are options out there. There are plenty of options, but this is a discussion that I give families the options. These are the things that exist right now, and it is their decision what they choose to do. They just need to know what are the pluses and the minuses and the risks for each one of the options. So the nice thing is, you know, and you look around a meeting like this, and this is fantastic. You know, you have this enormous group of people to be a support group. So Immune Deficiency Foundation does a wonderful job of providing many forums for information support. We have these meetings, we have PI Connect, we have the individual patient disease face pages, chat rooms, etc. You know, they have organizations in Canada, Europe, Latin America that do similar things. And then there are, for certain diseases, there are disease-specific organizations, like if you have SCID or WISCOT or XLA, that maybe add some additional information. Your own doctor can be a great resource or source of information. And we talked earlier, somebody was asking, how do you get involved in clinical trials? Well, there is a website at the NIH. You can go to that and look at that. I mean, but your immunologist may have some resources that they can suggest to you. There are some things on the web. So the web is a good and a bad thing. There's lots of good information, and there's lots of bad information on the web, and you have to be a little bit careful about where you go for your information. So, you know, Susie's mother's aunt's website is probably not as reliable as the NIH or the CDC, but, you know, so you have to take some things on the web with a grain of salt. And, you know, this generation, they're very used to going to the web for lots and lots and lots of things. But as I tell my children, Wikipedia is not always correct. Okay, so give them a little primer and be careful about your sources of information. But NIH, their website has a lot of information. Certain things, like for newborn screening for SCID, there's a website called Baby's First Test that has a lot of great information. The CDC, the Center for Newborn Screening, has a lot of good information. There are many organizations that put out information. And then for some of the medicines, like for the gamma globulin companies have a lot of resources that they make available to patients, whether it is financial, like copay assistance programs, or there are many of these companies that will actually provide product for someone if they have a lapse in insurance. These sorts of things are very helpful. And again, this goes back to teaching our patients to be resourceful. How can they make it work when things are happening that are maybe beyond your control, but you need a little help at that point? Many of them also have nursing advice lines. So you're having trouble with your infusions, you're not sure what you should do next, they may be able to provide some advice or some tips on what you can do. So there are many resources out there. In addition to sort of kind of forcing our kids to grow up and do some of these things like make their own appointments, we also need to give them, though, some other tools that help them problem solve. Now, I often joke about the millennial generation are not necessarily the best problem solvers in the world. But, you know, my daughter, my older daughter, she put out a very nice speech, and she said, you know, that's not true. We are group problem solvers. We use the internet, whether it's Tumblr, Facebook, you know, any one of these numerous social organizations, to group problem solve. And it's true. They often will put something out there and then get feedback from a whole bunch of people. Now, quality of feedback may be, you know, not so great. But it is a way to look at it, that they actually are willing to do this group problem solving. So maybe we can harness that a little bit and focus it a little bit. But it's a skill that they already know how to do. We just teach them how to make use of it in a good way. And that's it.